Psalms 19, verses 7 through 9. The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. So, now looking this evening at the fourth jewel of God, now that we've given a brief summary of this morning's three jewels, the fourth jewel that's listed in verse 8 is the commandment of the Lord. This commandment, or the Hebrew word for it, many of you have heard because of the popularizing of Jewish ceremonies, the Hebrew word is mitzvah. Mitzvah. You've all heard it. You hear about the Jewish boy going through his bar mitzvah. Well, mitzvah here is always referred to as the commandment of the Lord. And we find that the psalmist here puts a unique slant on the commandment of the Lord, because usually when mitzvah is used in the Old Testament, or many times at least, it refers to the commandments, plural, of the Lord. But the psalmist here said the commandment of the Lord, is pure, enlightening the eyes. Now our minds almost always again drift, as I said this morning, when we read the word law in the Bible, it almost always drifts to the Ten Commandments. And again, when we hear the word commandment or commandments in the Bible, our minds seem to drift to the Ten Commandments. It's because we're familiar with them. So when we see this word, that's where our minds go. But we see from God's statement back in Genesis 26 and verse 5, and I'll read that for you for the sake of time. We see from a statement that God made back there that commandment must mean something more than the Ten Commandments, because back there in Genesis 26, 5, He was talking about something that Abraham did before the Ten Commandments were ever written. Now listen to what He says, so that you get the gist of the fact that the word commandment in the Old Testament means more than just the Ten Commandments. It even means more than any other commandments that God might have given the children of Israel while they traveled through the wilderness. Listen to Him. Genesis 26:5. He says, "Because that Abraham obeyed My voice and kept My charge, My commandments." The same word that we see here that the psalmist picked up to sing about. My commandments, the mitzvah. So, Abraham was keeping the commandments of God before there ever was a Ten Commandments on a tablet of stone. And so, we have to understand that it must mean more than the code of regulations that God gave to the children of Israel on Mount Sinai, and it does. So what do we need to understand that this singular word, commandment, means as the psalmist has used it in this song? What are we supposed to take or understand it to mean? I believe that if you'll carefully study the word, the use of the word mitzvah in the Old Testament and its reference in the singular, you'll find out or come to the conclusion, as I did, that it's referring to the whole demand of obedience to God that God has given to humankind. Or put in other words, it is the act of God in commanding us to do something. The act as an institution. Not as that God gave one commandment, but any time God gives a commandment, it is a commandment. And when we think about God doing it, that's God giving a commandment. And in that sense, it becomes an institution, or referenced as an institution. So let's think of it as an institution like we think about, say, human society. Well, we know that there's more than one human society. There's a human society of the Western world, human society of the Orient, and so on and so on. But that's a phrase we use that's called an institution. Marriage is an institution. Not everybody in here is married to each other. And yet, when we talk about marriage, we can talk about it as though it's a singular thing. Marriage, Paul says, is honorable in all. And by that he meant any marriage anywhere that's consecrated of God is honorable in all. The institution is honorable in all. So when we think about commandment in this song, in that sense, then we can get to the place in our minds where we understand how we can properly think about the psalmist singing about it here. So this is about the body of God's demands upon creation as one unit. All the commandments of God were given because God gives a commandment, one after the other. Now, we see that this verse of Scripture says that the commandment, singular, the institution commandment of the Lord is pure. And that means from the first command we ever read about, I'm sure there were other commands because there were angels around to be commanded, but the first command we ever hear about in the Bible is when the Spirit of God moves upon the face of the deep in Genesis 1, and God gives out a command. What was the command? Let there be light. That was the first one we know about. That's a command. Now, He don't tell us to let there be light. He gives us commands as human that have to do with human affairs. But that was the first command we ever heard about. And there's going to be a last command that ties into time. I'm sure there'll be other commands to follow. But the last command that we hear about in Revelation 10, verse 6, from an angel, where the commandment of God must have taken place, in which God has said that time shall be no more. So from the first commandment that we ever heard till the last commandment that will relate to time, they're all of them, as a body or an institution, are pure. The commandment of the Lord is pure. So this is how we want to think about anything God gives a mandate about is pure. Now, most humans, almost all humans without the Spirit of God, rebel against any commandment from God. Many times humans in the flesh don't even know they're doing that, but they're doing it. And it's because man has a rebellious nature from Adam. And so they reject or rebel against the commandment of God. But God, regardless of how humans respond to the commandment of God, God's commandment is still pure. That is, it's unsullied. It's not in any way mixed with anything else but purity. And of course, those of you who understand God understand that that's the only way the commandment of God could be, because if it comes from one who's totally pure, it can only be totally pure. Well, so what are the attributes then of the commandment of God? The commandment of the Lord is pure, I said, and I pointed out that this simply means that there's no admixture of anything in it. There's no contradicting principles in any command of God. You might imagine that because God commands one thing to give life and another thing to give death, that there may be a contradiction or a cross purpose in that, but there isn't. The difference between the real truth about men imagining that there are cross purposes in the commandments of God is that men don't understand what the commandments are all about. They don't understand what God's doing. Otherwise, they would understand, and when you come to the understanding of knowing that God is right in all His doings, then you can understand clearly that the commandment of God is pure. But as long as you think like a human about the commandments of God, then God commanding life on this side and death on this side will seem like a contradiction. But it isn't. Because the commandment of God is pure. No mixture of different principles or contradicting purposes in God's commandment. We ought to view all of God's commandments as a body of God's demands upon humanity in that way, and it'll help us in our reasoning process when we start trying to comprehend why things are ordered by the Lord the way that they are. Our biggest trouble with understanding God is we think things ought to be this way, and all of a sudden we notice God's doing them this way. And we say, wait, I thought they ought to go this way. But God is allowing them to go this way. Diane and I had a conversation, I believe it was yesterday evening, about we didn't fully understand why God let wicked men get away with the extent of things that He does. And then we turned right around and answered the question simply by saying or in agreeing that it was because God has purposes that are unified in this action. God has unified purposes in this which we can't understand. We're too mixed up between sin and righteousness. We have the righteous man within us that understands the mind of Christ, but we have the old Adamic nature in us that understands the nature of Adam and the things of Adam, and they think differently, and they're confusing, to say the least, to the human creature that we are. But when we understand that regardless of how we think about it, God's commandment is pure, then that helps us to comprehend some orderliness in the way God demands that things be done. Now, what's the benefit of the commandment of God to His creatures? The verse tells us the benefit is this. The commandment of God, or of the Lord, is pure, enlightening the eyes. Now, the first thing that this suggests to us, it ought to come immediately to our minds. Maybe it doesn't, but it ought to. The first thing that we think about is if we read this right, we come to realize that with all of our ability as human beings to see details, and believe me, human beings are smart folks. I mean, a creature that started out depending on a garden dressed of the Lord and a garden that He dressed Himself and getting all of His food from there and not having one automated piece of machinery and nothing looking like a wagon wheel or a car or an airplane or a space rocket. He went all the way to the place of having people walk around on the moon. So man's smart. But for all that smartness and all that acumen, ability to see details, figure out details, and scope things out, for all of that, man, concerning spiritual things, left to himself, either has poor vision at best, or is blind altogether. And man, left to his own human devices, always wanders around in darkness until his eyes are turned by the grace of God to the light of God's heavenly truths. And that's the first thing that we ought to think about when we think about the benefit that the Bible tells us here is given to His creatures, enlightening the eyes. It's the commandment of God that turns the light bulb on in our brains about what God is doing. Now, brothers and sisters, this is important because normally we just take the commandments of God. We look at how God gives charges to men, makes demands upon men, and from the flesh side of it, it looks like an imposition upon human beings. The things that God demands that we do look like impositions upon us. And yet, if we look closer at God's commandment, how it's structured, we come to realize that within the structure of the way God tells us to do things and the things that He tells us to do lies the secret to understanding the mysteries of the universe. Now, this is the falling off place for humankind because we probe out into the world of science with all of our scientific ingenuity and knowledge and mental capacity, and we look in directions other than toward God for the answers to the mysteries of the universe, when in fact, the enlightening of the eyes, that's a Hebrew phrase that connotes getting understanding, being able to have the light bulb turned on. The enlightening of the eyes comes from understanding the commandment of God. And when we do that, we gain knowledge. We gain understanding. We see the details that God has created and the details that God is operating by. So true understanding comes to humans by obeying the commands of God. Of course, you can't come to an understanding of the commands if you don't obey them. I mean, you can't... Can you tell me what a glass of milk tastes like without ever having drunk one? I don't think so. And you can't tell me what heat feels like if you've never touched it, or it's never touched you. And in the same way, we can't come to a knowledge and get an enlightenment from the commandment of God without obeying the commandment of God. God just got it linked together. Obey, and I'll enlighten your eyes and make you see some things that you can't see otherwise. So like eye drops often clear our reddened and tired eyes so that our blurred vision clears up when we use a little Visine or distilled water or something in our eyes. In this same way, the commands of God enable us to see better what the issues of life are and what it's all about and what is important for mankind. That's the fourth jewel. The fifth jewel is seen in verse 9, and we read this, "The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever." Now, the psalmist here looks like he picks something a little out of context to be amongst these six jewels. I'm not going to say much about this, but I do want to point out something about this fifth jewel. And that is that although we often see the fear of God as something that's generated in us, by us, really, the psalmist understood it more clearly than we do. And what he understood and the reason he was able to place it in this jewelry box of God amidst the six other five jewels is because if a child of God, if a human being has the fear of the Lord that the psalmist is singing about, he got it from God. God generated that fear in him. The Bible tells us that those who are profane in every way and rebels against God, that the fear of God is not within them. They have no fear of God before their eyes. And so, when we talk about the fear of the Lord in this song and elsewhere, the fear of the Lord that is clean and enduring forever, it's a fear that's in the souls of saved folks, not lost folks. Because lost folks haven't yet learned how to fear God. They may have some fear, and in fact, we see a paganized and a corrupted fear amongst almost all human societies, a fear of God. But have you ever noticed that when heathen and idolaters exhibit that they fear God, they show that fear towards some stone object or towards some god that isn't a god, the sun, the moon, something like that. They don't show fear or exhibit the fear toward Jehovah that God's talking about here. Children of God only can do that. And when men do it because they have this corrupted fear, it's born, it gives birth to idolatry, to superstition, and to malice. So fear's twisted in the hearts of lost people. But for believers, fear of the Lord is clean, just like our verse says. And it's clean because it provokes us to reverence of the great God of heaven. It is because of fear that we reverence God. And I've always been a great proponent of growing love for God. I think there's nothing can do more for your human soul as a child of God than to grow in your love for your God and Savior. But there's a place for the fear of God. There ought to be a place for the fear of God. I believe that God puts it in the hearts of His people because He wants it to have a place there. And that place is to provoke His people to reverence and obedience to Him when love is at such a low ebb in us that we might not otherwise be obedient to Him. And you know, I've also said that it's the love of God that will provoke the children of God to be obedient to God more strongly than any other thing. But the love of God in most of us is weak, to say the least. And at times when we ought to do something for the Lord because we love Him deeply, sometimes it's only the fear of God that can provoke us to do something for God. The love just isn't strong enough. So God's fear has its place. And the psalmist is singing about things that here apply to believers, this fear of God. So, I think also that clean, this verse saying that the fear of the Lord is clean, implies that the fear of the Lord has a cleansing power also. And that's what I've been talking about really, because it's the reverential fear of God that produces a cleansing upon God's people. And I mean a cleansing in habit and a cleansing in thought. If we understand that God is a God of grace and a God of mercy, we appreciate the grace of God, the mercy of God. But sometimes God's grace and mercy are inclined to be used as an excuse for doing something that we know is wrong. But you ever let a child of God get a good taste of the fear of God, and while mercy and grace are there and large from the Lord, fear will cause God's people many times to walk a straight and narrow, regardless of the fact that they understand that God is a God of grace and mercy. So, it has a cleansing power to it. This is the fifth jewel of God, the fear of the Lord. And the sixth jewel we see in verse 9. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. The judgments of the Lord are the sixth jewel. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. Now, if you want a good base word to think about in the English language to understand what the psalmist is singing about here, think of the word verdict or the idea of passing sentence. And you'll have a clear Hebrew understanding of what the Hebrew means here about the judgments of the Lord. If we were saying it in the modern English, we'd say the verdicts are the sentencing that God passes. These verdicts or these sentencings are true and righteous altogether. And that gives us the meaning or the understanding of it in the English language for today. So the verdicts of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. What does this mean? It means that the Lord makes no mistakes when He passes a verdict or declares a sentence. Those verdicts, those sentences that God passes are always true. That is, right on. They're accurate to the nth degree. They're exactly fitting for the purpose. We sometimes hear human beings accuse our God of cruelty if we're saying that our God judges men worthy of eternal death and casts them into hell. It's become a modern day thing today to be teaching and preaching that there is no hell. And people say, well, if I believed in a God like that, I couldn't possibly serve Him because that's cruel and unfair and unjust. No, it isn't. It's the true verdict of God. From the very beginning, He told human beings, and it's been passed down. If you disobey, if you don't believe, if you reject My Son, you will go to hell. And all through the ages, this has been the teaching, that disobedience to God brings judgment. And when God passes that verdict, He's true. True to Himself, true to His Word. He's true to the man, the human being, that lived in His world and disobeyed Him. He's true altogether. So the Lord makes no mistakes when He passes a verdict or declares a sentence. Now, one of the best illustrations of this came up in a conversation between Brother Ed and Brother Mark last week. that I overheard. This is the best illustration I've ever heard of this thing of the verdicts of God being true. These two brothers were talking about the fact that the video camera was taking over umpire calling. And they were discussing a specific incident where an umpire called it one way, and the cameras rerun, shot the scene, and sure enough, the umpire called it wrong. So they made the ruling based on what the video had shown. Well, to illustrate what we're talking about here, when we find someone making a judgment in the human frame, as human beings, in the human condition, from the human objective and from the human standpoint, that's the umpire. He'll make a judgment call based on subjectivity, we call it. Whereas that means that he saw it a certain way. He might have missed a few details, but from his vantage point, where he was looking at it, this is the way he saw it, and he called it that way. On the other hand, the camera was able to shoot from every angle, and it saw every angle of the incident. It was able to objectively, without discrimination, without any weakness of eyes, without any problems with personal prejudices, the camera was able to see everything that came to pass, and the judgment could be rendered objectively based on what the camera saw. The camera is like God. God sees it all. He sees the inside and the out of every single thing. And so when He passes a verdict or hands down a sentence, that sentence, that verdict is true. It's right on. That's the way it works with God. His judgments, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. Now this truth is important because many human beings have accused the Lord of injustice, of severe and unfair judgment. We hear it all the time. But God is never unfair in His judgments. He is never prejudiced in His handing out His verdicts. He never will be, because God knows what it's all about from all angles. Now, that leaves me to realize that at the final judgment, how true it is when the Bible says that every mouth will be shut tight and the whole world will become guilty before God. God will be vindicated and proven to be fair and righteous in every sentence that He passes in judgment day. There won't be any hidden agendas. There won't be any prejudices of God. And there won't be any hiding of any reasons why God has passed judgment. Everything will be open and clear. And when God passes a verdict, hands down a verdict, all of creation will be able to see why it was done that way. Even those who oppose God, their mouths will be shut. They will not have an objection to raise against the great God of grace. Six jewels of God, six wonderful jewels of God that He's given us by which we can live and understand Him and pursue things spiritual that are meaningful in our day-to-day lives for the Lord. I know this look at the six jewels of God has been a little complicated, and I wish that I could get it out a little more clearly. But I trust the Lord has blessed you to understand that God has things within His person, that His precepts are the driving force for why we have regulations the way we do from God, and that the testimony of God is sure, it is perfect, it is complete. The testimony of God is trustworthy and will always be right, and that the fear of God, the fear of the Lord, is pure, and it drives men that understand and have fear of the Lord. It drives men to purity themselves. It cleanses the soul. When we understand these things, we've gotten our hands on the jewels that the Lord has laid before us in His Word.